back at the end of 2015, there was a call for proposals went out and a workshop that was held basically to discuss concepts for astronomical CubeSat missions. Now, these had to be scientifically justified, by which I mean you had to be able to justify the mission purely on the scientific return, not just technology development or developing experience, valuable as those things are. It was limited to the CubeSat form factor of between 1 and 6 units. Anything larger was considered too ambitious. And it needed to be fundable within existing Australian grant schemes, which probably know is a very tight constraint on this sort of thing. And it should be something that you could do within the relatively near future. So no completely new technologies needing to be developed, that sort of thing. And so the Australian Space Eye was one of the concepts we developed in response to this call. And it's been evolving since that time. So it's, you know, the basis is a 6U CubeSat, and we're looking at doing wide-field broadband imaging of the night sky in the 700 to 1,000 nanometer range. And the reason why we're looking there is you can do it with conventional silicon image sensors, but you benefit from being above the atmosphere because you avoid the strong atmospheric airglow emission at those wavelengths. And that the key there is minimizing systematic errors, because you really need to find something that has to be done above the atmosphere and couldn't be done from the ground for much less expense. A couple of science goals, which I'll go into a little bit more detail on. So the main science goal now is a measurement of the optical extragalactic background light, and we're also interested in doing some low surface brightness imaging nearby galaxies. So just explain a little bit about this. So the extragalactic background light is simply the sum of the light from all of the sources that are too faint or diffuse to detect individually. To make it sound a bit more impressive, you can describe it as a measurement of the total luminosity of the universe, integrated over history along the line of sight. Now, this is very well constrained at some wavelengths. For example, the cosmic microwave background has been studied in enormous detail, and a great deal has been learned from that. But at other wavelengths, it's much less well known. And that includes the optical and infrared. There's a few reasons for that. One is the atmosphere, which makes ground-based measurements very difficult, and the other is zodiacal light, which I'll come to in a second. So in the near infrared, there have been measurements of the extragalactic background light anisotropy, so the power structure of the power spectrum of the variations, with sounding rockets. Cyber took some measurements of this, and there's a Cyber 2 mission starting that'll do it in optical and infrared. And that was a very, very successful result, and it does give you some insights into the nature of the sources that you're looking at. However, Cyber did try to do an absolute photometry of the extragalactic background light at around the same wavelengths that we're looking at, but with a sounding rocket, you're very limited in the total exposure time. You're limited to a small instrument, like you are with a small satellite, but they had a total of 4 flights for about an hour of total measurements. Whereas for these photometry measurements, you need a lot more time, so you really need an orbital mission for it. So this is something that would complement these measurements from Cyber 2. And the key difficulty here is separating the extragalactic background light that cosmologists are interested in from the foregrounds. And the main one is the zodiacal light. So this is sunlight that is scattered off the dust within the solar system. And you also galactic cirrus, which is starlight scattered off dust within the galaxy. The other aspect is low surface brightness imaging of nearby galaxies. So what we're looking for is these faint diffuse structures in and around these galaxies, things like tidal tails, streams and shells, essentially the debris of galaxy formation. So if you can study these things, you do get insights into the formation history of these galaxies. Now, conventional large telescopes aren't optimized for this sort of extended emission. They're much better at detecting faint point sources, and it's because they have certain amounts of internal scattering of light, stray light. And small telescopes with enough time can be very competitive here. So there's examples from the Dragonfly telescope, formerly known as Dragonfly Telephoto Array. So, yes, this thing, Dragonfly Telephoto Array, up until recently it looked like that on the left, and on the right is a more recent picture. It's an array of telephoto camera lenses. And the nice thing about these is that they have a very clean image, very little scattered light, very little internal reflections, and this enables you to separate point sources from the diffuse stuff you're looking for. This Dragonfly Telephoto Array recently discovered ultra-diffuse galaxies in the Coma Cluster. This is quite big news amongst astronomers. So these things, they are physically the size of the Milky Way, but with only about 1% the stars. These things are almost entirely dark matter, which presents some interesting questions for people who study galaxy formation. So there's this great work being done on the ground with small telescopes, but this works best in the fairly narrow visible optical band, whereas if you want to go to longer wavelengths, you start running into severe problems with atmospheric air glow. So by doing this from space, we can avoid that and extend this to longer wavelengths. This is what I think it might look like. It looks like a 6U CubeSat, i.e. a shoebox with a few things sticking out. So some deployable solar panels. The telescope runs through the middle with a baffle in front of it, Star Trek cameras and so on. Now, my background is astronomical instrumentation, so I leap straight to the telescope. There's a image sensor looking at using an E2V CMOS image sensor. Main advantage for us is that it's small pixels, which means the telescope focal length can be smaller and the whole thing fits more easily within the space. I have baseline optical design, so it's a refracting telescope rather than a reflecting telescope, more commonly used, or cathode optic design. And the aim is to get the cleanest possible images we can, absolutely minimize stray light by every means available to us. The key is separating the extragalactic background light and the zodiacal light, and we plan to do this with a set of 6 optical filters to isolate, take images in certain bands. So here are some nominal INZ band filters, astronomical broadband filters, and superimposed on there is a simulated spectrum of the zodiacal light, which is very much like the solar spectrum, but a little reddened. And the key feature is here, where these filters meet. We get these stronger absorption lines. These are the calcium triplet absorption lines. They're there in the solar spectrum, but they're not there in the extragalactic background light. So if you're able to measure the depth of these lines on the sky, you can work out what fraction is from the zodiacal light and which is from the extragalactic background light. So we have a set of slightly different filters with an edge that cuts off just before, just after, and a little bit further along from the strongest line there. And so by taking differences of these filters and sums, we can get the overall flux, but also the ratios from the different sources. So we've done some performance modelling on this to help work out a concept for operations. So we're looking at a nominal 2-year mission in a polar orbit, about 600 kilometres, just staring at 2 carefully chosen fields, one in the north, one in the south, for roughly half the time, to build up enough signal, despite the fact we're working with a very, very small telescope. There's a few main technical challenges with doing astronomy in a CubeSat. The first is pointing stability. We need to take long exposures because we're looking at faint night sky, so we need to hold the instrument steady to roughly an arc second or so, which is well beyond the capabilities of an off-the-shelf attitude determination and control system. So spacecraft is going to be based around the Tyvek Endeavour platform, which is high performance for a CubeSat. So you get star trackers, magnetometers, reaction wheels, commanded data handling, computer, ADCS processor, torque coils, pretty much everything you need for functional spacecraft apart from batteries and solar panels. Based on some modelling that Tyvek have done with us, they reckon we could get to about 10 arc second pointing stability, so still about an order of magnitude short of what we really want. So the solution that we're looking at is to add a second stage to stabilise the camera itself by putting the image sensor on piezo XY actuators and moving the image sensor around. It's not an entirely new idea. It's been used in a number of instruments and devices, so we're pretty confident this is going to work. And we think it will work, provided we run this loop at a 20 hertz with less than an arc second or so of noise and a small delay, 1 millisecond or so. So the other challenge is thermal control. The image sensor we're looking at using doesn't need to be cryogenically cooled to work at its best sensitivity, but it does need to be at about minus 40. And being a CubeSat, of course, we don't have much power or volume or mass to spare. We need to do this almost entirely passively. We've done some thermal modelling. UNSW Canberra did this. And they've come up with a solution that appears to work based on these models. So there's a radiator coupled to the image sensor with a baffle around it to shield it from most of the UV flux from the Earth. And it turns out that provided we do some manoeuvres during each orbit to minimise the Earth IR when we're not observing, be only observing for about 30-40 minutes of the orbit, then it all works. So this is the results of those models. This top line is without doing any manoeuvres. This bottom line is with, and so the sensor temperature here spends most of its time below minus 40, and the observation periods are actually in here. So it's fine. We're achieving that minus 40 with passive cooling, so then we can stabilise it. So status, we're currently waiting to hear on the result of a ARC LEAF grant, gone in with a consortium of seven Australian universities, the AAO, TIVAC, Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and there they are, in fact. ARC LEAF grant went in this year, which would fund the design, completion, construction, testing, launch, and commissioning. And we hope to find out whether we've been funded in probably early November, likely to find out. And that would then lead into a three-year project timetable, pretty tight, pretty ambitious, but we'll certainly do our best and look for a launch in second half of 2019.